Prime Minister takes his first trip to Israel Saturday. What's on the agenda, and what will Israel gain from the visit? The Israeli ambassador to Canada joins me. Plus, another cargo train explosion renews calls for rail safety.
The time for excuses is over. The Conservatives have to start acting now in matters of rail safety and protection of the public.
With an increase in crude oil transport, what rules will ensure the protection of municipalities? And the dollar is down. Will a low-flying loonie lift up our manufacturing sector? Two senior economists on whether a low dollar will boost or bust Canada's economy. A week from now, Prime Minister Stephen Harper will make his first visit to the Middle East. The first stop will be Israel before he travels to the Palestinian Authority in Jordan. Harper has established a close personal bond with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Israeli government is planning to give Harper red carpet treatment, including an invitation to address the country's parliament. Joining me now from Jerusalem is Rafael Barak, the Israeli ambassador to Canada. First, Mr. Ambassador, I have to ask you about the death of Ariel Sharon. He was a legendary wartime general and a controversial political figure. What do you think his contribution has been to Israeli society?
Well, as you rightly said, Robert, he was a great general, but particularly I will highlight his attitude vis-a-vis peace in this region. He took a serious risk when you remember in 2005 we withdrew from Gaza. He wanted to give peace a chance. He did it. He paid a political price. He quit his party, the Likud party, and created a new party in order to push forward this solution with the Palestinians. Unfortunately, instead of that, we have now in Gaza Hamas shelling our citizens. But I think this was his biggest contribution to peace. And as you rightly said, he was also a big general and a very important politician that contributes also to the welfare of my country.
Mr. Ambassador, this is the Prime Minister's first ever visit to Israel. What is on the agenda and what does Israel want out of this visit?
Yes, well, we are very excited here in Jerusalem, waiting for Prime Minister Harper. As you rightly said, he has a particular bond with my Prime Minister. He will be very well received, as well as his delegation. And I feel that this will be a very important visit, not only on our bilateral relations, but also will enable Mr. Harper to look around our beautiful country.
Well, Ambassador, some critics in Canada have argued that the Prime Minister's Middle East policy is too one-sided toward Israel, and it limits our opportunities to be a player in the peace process. What's your view on that?
Well, I feel that Canada is a very friendly country towards Israel for many years. This year we were going to celebrate 65 years of diplomatic relations. And Canada also has been contributing to peace in different ways, in international forums, bilaterally. So I feel that this friendship belongs to this government definitely. But I see that in all the parties in Canada, there is a particular friendship and a particular interest and support to the positions of my country.
Well, let's look at the fact that the Prime Minister named Vivian Berkovits as Canada's new envoy to Israel. She's an outspoken critic of Palestinian leaders and really has been a cheerleader for Prime Minister Netanyahu. Are we sending a negative signal to the Palestinians when we pick an envoy who is so critical of them?
Well, you know, we feel that the position of Canada is reflecting what we feel that their objective matters, and this is the reality. Canada understands our positions. They also attach attention to the Palestinians in different ways through the assistance they are given to the Palestinian people. When it comes to take a decision, they understand that this should be taken by the parties, by the Palestinians and the Israelis. But they are very supportive to our demands, particularly in Israel security. This is the first point. And secondly, being Israel the Jewish state.
By the end of April, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he wants to see a peace deal secured between the Israelis and Palestinians. One of the stumbling blocks is your Prime Minister's decision to build more settlements in Palestinian territories. Kerry calls those settlements illegitimate.
Well, you know, settlements have never been an obstacle to peace. The importance is that we are now negotiating with the Palestinians. We are in a framework that maybe will bring us to some kind of a general elements in which we will continue to finalize a negotiation that is going along for 20 years. We feel that with goodwill and political will, we'll be able to finalize this negotiation, but it demands compromise not only from my country, but compromise for the other side too.
But many people in Israel are also divided as well over Netanyahu's stand. Some Israeli commentators have said that his goal is actually to buy time, to do nothing, while never giving an inch.
Well, you know, here is Israel is the democracy, is the only democracy in the Middle East, and everybody, and we have a coalition government. So there are different interpretations to the policy. I feel that everybody can understand that we cannot conduct a negotiation openly through the media. This should be a discreet negotiation. And believe me, there is a discreet negotiation going on with the full support of the United States.
On Iran, it's a major player in the region. There are negotiations going on now to see if they can reach some kind of an agreement with them in terms of their atomic weapons programs. Did the Prime Minister of Canada make a mistake by severing diplomatic ties with Iran? Isn't it wiser to keep the door open to your enemies?
Well, you know, this is not for me to judge decisions taken by the Canadian government. We feel pretty supportive, expressing the skepticism to the decisions taken just a few weeks ago in Geneva. It's the same skepticism that my country and my government is feeling vis-a-vis Iran. Iran is a threat, is a multiple threat on the nuclear facilities that they are preparing, on the missiles that can reach easily the southern Mediterranean countries, on the terrorism and the influence, bad influence in Syria. And there were more than 450 people who were killed this year in Iran. So this is not a good example of human rights. So this is Iran, and we feel very satisfied that we have a joint and common view on this important issue in the Middle East.
Well, Ambassador, we'll see you next Sunday in Israel.
Thank you very much.
150 residents of Plaster Rock, New Brunswick were evacuated last week after a nearby train burst into flames after derailing. The cars that caught fire were carrying hazardous materials like crude oil and liquefied petroleum gas. Between January and November last year, 130 rail accidents occurred across Canada involving dangerous goods. Those included derailments, collisions, fires and explosions, and crossing accidents. Several of those under investigation include the tragedy in Lac-Mégantic last July. Transport Canada was criticized by the Auditor General in his report last November, saying the department failed to properly ensure rail companies were operating safely. But on December 26, new safety rules were quietly introduced in response to the Lac-Mégantic disaster. For more on that, joining me now, Canadian Railway Association President Michael Bourque, and from Transport Action Canada, David Jeans. Mr. Moore, tell us about these new rules that were brought in.
Well, you might remember that after that terrible accident in Lac-Mégantic, there were emergency rules put into place under Section 33 of the Railway Safety Act. And those naturally expired under the Act. They can only be in place for 6 months. So they were set to expire on December 31st. And so, following those rules, the department, the minister, issued another order under Section 19 of the Act, telling us in the railway industry to draft permanent rules that would replace the emergency order. And those are for the securement of trains to make sure that that an accident like the one that happened at Lac-Mégantic couldn't happen again. So that's what we did.
But one of the rules you dropped, though, was that there had to be somebody continually there when there's hazardous material when the train is stopped. You took that away.
That's true, but you have to remember that there are some 144,000 cars on our railway network today and every day. And the emergency order was very much a blanket order. And following that, in designing a rule, the objective was really to make sure that we dealt with some of the critical issues that were at least identified initially from Lac-Mégantic to try and make sure that the same kind of accident couldn't happen again. But there was, I don't think, ever any idea by anybody that you could always have somebody on board every train in the country at all times. It's just not physically possible.
Mr. Jeans, one of the biggest problems, it seems to me, and if you read about it, is that the 70% or so of the dangerous cargo that's being transported are in cars that are really outdated. The metal is too thin, and they need brand new cars to be able to, particularly to carry the new kind of fuel that's now being transported. Unless that happens, we're still going to have a lot more accidents, are we not?
Well, that was certainly identified as a problem immediately after Lac-Mégantic. And it's my understanding that the railways, both in Canada and the United States, have in fact been urging the regulators to force the industry to move towards the use of more modern and better protected cars. Remember, those cars are mostly not owned by the railways. They're owned by the shippers, by the oil companies who are extracting oil, by the refineries that are receiving the oil, or perhaps by other leasing companies. And so it's actually a concern of the railways as well as a concern of the public. The basic problem, my understanding, is that just a huge percentage of the existing cars on the railway are of that older DOT 111 type. And with the huge growth in transport of crude oil that we've seen over the past year or so, there hasn't been any other alternative up to now. But I think the pressure is going to be on to invest heavily in better protected cars.
So basically the oil companies are saying, we don't want to spend the money, and the railways are saying, look, you should spend the money because we're going to have more and more of these accidents. And where does the government lie in here? Because they have a responsibility here.
Yeah, I don't agree with you. I don't think the oil companies are